Staging Sound, a podcast reflecting on theatre music, sound design, sonic practices and experiences. Okay, welcome. Welcome to this episode of Staging Sound. This is still part of the conference proceedings release of the podcast, where we reflect on the conference we had in Munich in September 2023, entitled Theatre Sound as Collaboration. The next four episodes are sort of a unit in that they present a particular panel on a particular day. They are based on audio papers that we asked contributors to submit ahead of time, which we then all, as participants of the conference, were able to listen to. And we then discussed these papers in a panel discussion between Adrian Curtin, Dushka Radosavljevic, and myself. So the next three episodes are the actual audio papers as they were submitted. And the fourth episode then is the discussion and reflection of these submissions. Now, today's episode includes the first two of these audio papers, and these were submitted by Victoria Deorio from Chicago and Jimmy Eady from Dublin. Many thanks again for these interesting papers, and enjoy the episode.
What is it that sound designers do? I'm always reminded how elusive my job, my art, my craft is when someone asks me what I do. I have the automatic response of, I create sound design and compositions for theater. All non-theater people hear is sound, music, theater, and think talented artists. But they really do not know the depth of what those entail. Some will go as far as to engage in conversation regarding the sound engineer they saw at the last music venue to which they went. And then some will not have even heard the word sound in my answer and ask me about the scenery. Very few times do I have the ability to go into detail about the supportive nature of the job, how sound design creates the emotional journey for an audience, how it helps the audience not have to think too hard about where they are since they understand sonic spatial relationships without having to tell them, or how sound design is about how the speaker system is set up for the delivery of such sound, and how vastly different that can be based on the production that you are supporting. They don't know that it takes a team to do it, and that that team is led by me, who is part of another team that is led by the director. They do not understand why, when I'm in tech, I'm expected to be working 14 to 16 hours a day because of a 12-hour U.S. equity union workday, and then my personal work notes before or after. Now, in the past, sound designers and theater in Chicago were looked at as magicians. We created fully realized soundscapes in small theaters with no budget, all at a time when technology was not so simple as pushing one button to run a show. The added hours of not being able to work during the tech day and having to go home and complete notes before the next day were brutal. But it was all worth it because of the respect and admiration for how hard the work really is to pull off successfully. I mean, we all know when sound is wrong, and trust me, people will tell you bluntly what they think about your work. However, here's the notable idea that I wish to instill. Even though sound design appears to be really simple with the advent of computer technology, its fundamental intention of artistically striving for full support of an emotional journey, and technically to deliver the richness of design, are still very hard work. When I say this among other disciplines of design, this is usually when comparisons begin between departments. I'm not here to say that any one design department is more difficult than another. They all have their challenges in modern theater production. But the one thing I can say with certainty is that the time arts of sound, lighting, and projection are challenging because so much of it happens in front of other people who are evaluating the content as you create it. And additionally, you can't see sound. There is nothing tangible except the impression upon the audience. So as a designer, you have to ensure that you are creating the exact response the director and the team expect from the language you have all used to discuss what the audience would take away from the production. And those meetings began 5 months to a year prior. But if you can't see sound, there's no way to fully evaluate until you are really there in the context of the moment. Everyone knows that when it's dark, even if the actors are enhanced by microphones, the audience will psychologically believe that they cannot hear them. If you have the same attenuation level set for an actor in both a bright setting and a dim setting, chances are you will have to change that level in the darker setting to help the audience hear when they can't see them as clearly. Sound must work with the psychology of the audience. However, it's not only psychology, it's physiology as well. There's an evolutionary response to sound where we as designers play with the chemical reaction of fight or flight. Imagine any horror film where there are low drones which stimulate your predator-prey response because anything that emits frequencies that low is bigger and stronger than you. Or maybe it's the sharp and or loud sound that comes out of nowhere that shock you into running for cover. These produce chemical reactions by affecting the sympathetic and the parasympathetic nervous system. Anthropologically, there is an associational response to sound, where we all associate different times and events to a particular moment when we heard something, and it created a neural pathway of remembrance. But the added intricacy to this is that we all have different associations to the same sound. Luckily for us in entertainment, there are some tropes that have developed that help tell the story through a collective consciousness. Birds will be morning, crickets will be night, even though animals make their noises and sounds all day long. And in theater, lightning and thunder hit at the same time, or else it may look like a mistake in the calling of the cue. But in life, if that were to happen, you would have been struck by lightning. And speaking from experience, if you are that close to a strike, there is no thunder. The best part of theater is that we as artists present something live to an audience for them to develop their own thoughts and opinions about. When you present a scenario with live people in front of someone, they have the same reaction as if it is real. However, in theater, the assumption we all have is that it is done with the safety of the presenters and the audience in mind. We all know the fights are choreographed, and without the fear of danger, it is more fun to watch. That's why the only reason why a roller coaster is fun is because you're strapped in safely. Thematically, we can show them the past to comment on the present day, or we can create a future beyond our wildest imaginations. These spark conversation and debate. And this is what we all wish to occur after the curtain comes down. For sound, when it comes to understanding the space around us in the dark, it is the strongest design element that can erase the walls of the theater without having to show the audience. Because we hear in 360 degrees, and because sound as it travels through space is the embodiment of time, the spatial relationship of the environment we place an audience in is recognizable without them perceptively acknowledging that sound is the element that is creating this reality for them. Depending on how large the space is or how reverberant the containment of that space we are trying to create, we can tell the audience a great deal. From a cathedral to a yoga studio, both are sacred spaces, but sound is completely different when contained within them. Sound picks up where the visual leaves off. Scenery, lights, costumes, and projections all end within a field of vision. Sound can encompass the audience. A human body is made up mostly of water. And if you've ever watched sound ripple on water or seen the somatic photos of sound frequencies with sand, this is what is resonating when we deliver sound to an audience. The look and feel of dissonant sound are very different than the look and feel of consonant sound. Larger and lower frequencies hit the body very differently than smaller or higher frequencies. When there is complexity of frequencies, the body is so engulfed that we tend to lose ourselves within it because we cannot discern where we begin or end physically because of the resonance. Additionally, with the creation and reminder of neural pathways of sound through the use of repetition, we use these tools to affect our audience with intention. But human beings don't hear the world around them one-to-one. Everything vibrates, and since everything that vibrates is causing an atmospheric shift, which in turn creates a frequency of that shift, that means that everything is making sound. Human beings purposely, selectively hear what is necessary for us to hear. Evolutionarily, we will stop hearing repetitive or constant sound if we are not in danger. And with associational response, once we have created the neural pathway and no longer need to hear a specific sound, we no longer tune into it. We selectively hear in our day-to-day existence. And in theater, we can use that tool to our advantage. Since we're working with a blank slate, as sound designers, we can purposefully set the sound to be the cacophony and then supply only what we want the audience to hear. This helps with the distraction and discovery by either highlighting an event or not. These are the choices we must make in order to guide the audience through the experience. So how does one learn this? Well, you simply base it off your own experience and try it out. Like I said before, someone will tell you if it's not producing the intended response. This means you must have a thick skin and not feel too protective of what you create, because it could change in an instant with someone not feeling right about it. The graciousness in which you present yourself as you create your art, like making sure that you formulate responses instead of reactions, will be your strongest ally. We are all human beings with emotional reactions to moments of misunderstanding effort or intention of our work. However, the important lesson to learn is that everyone in the room is vulnerable, and trust is essential to ensuring that you can take a breath and change that reaction into a response that is respectful to the fact that everyone in the room is aiming towards the same goal of how best to serve the vision of the production, and the best idea will always rise to the top. So how do you create the emotional journey? Sound designers begin from a place of impression upon the audience, as well as the artistic expression of the piece and the individuals creating it. From the beginning of your work on a piece, you will continually be asking yourself whose point of view the story is being told. This informs greatly whether the audience is empathetically engaged or emotionally feeling the same as the character they are witnessing, or if they are sympathetic to the emotions of the character by being an outside observer. An example of this is used in comedy a great deal. Let's say a character is having a really bad day, and it's raining, and their umbrella broke, and they stepped in a big puddle, and a car just splashed them while driving by them. Now, if we are empathetically feeling what the character is feeling, the music underscoring this would reflect this terrible day with punctuations for each new event that show that it's getting worse. But if the audience is to remain as an observer and it's funny to them, the music would be the exact opposite, and punctuations would show how absurdly comical it can be to laugh at another's misfortune. The expression of the sound design comes down to the intention of the impression upon the audience. We create themes to characters, objects, or ideas. We use repetition and subtle changes in those themes that help tell the story within the repetition. We use a range of dynamics with volume, pitch, speed, and complexity. We create tension by playing upon evolutionary response. We define spatially where we are through associations of time and space. We add to the ambience and the ambiance of creating a reality of the environment by choosing what the audience selectively hears. We set the pacing of the events through tempo, playing with time by speeding up, slowing down, jumping through it, or stopping it. We also play with what is concrete and what is abstracted in order to tell a story. And through all this, there is the decision to remain either cohesive, so as to not create further new discoveries and neural pathways, or not. It's all in the playing of the piece. This is what makes those early discussions so important. As the rest of the team sets up the visual aspect, how is sound going to deliver the content that will bring the audience on a journey? This forces the artists involved to think about the end goal of emotional response long before rehearsal begins, and that's not always very clear early on. Sometimes, especially with new plays or new innovations in theater, you will not fully understand the impact for which you are striving. But it is our job as sound designers to start somewhere, and to keep that conversation active and ongoing throughout the process. In the end, very few will truly understand the depth to which you have specifically put sound and music in a room, and you have to be okay with that. The way we as sound designers garner the respect for this work is to teach and explain how and why we are making our decisions as we make them. And I do not mean in a way that is pejorative, but in a way that reminds the artists that hearing goes beyond the sound effect and musical transitions. And even though you can't see it, it is the part of the production that actually interacts physically with the audience. So yeah, I create sound and music for theater.
Hello, my name is Jimmy Eady, and I am an Irish audio engineer, sound designer, and I also work in education in Trinity College Dublin, where I teach modules on audio production, engineering, and audio software development. So, collaboration for me within theatre is a practical and more or less obvious element of theatre production, I think. By definition, isn't theatre a collaborative art form? It's an interdisciplinary form, so anything you do has to fit in with the building blocks of the production as a whole. We are all working together, but ultimately we are adhering to the script, if there is a script. I've been lucky enough in my career to have worked with some great artists, but for the last few years I primarily work with a single company in Ireland called Pan Pan Theatre. They have been very great friends, Aideen and Gavin, since the early 90s. And with working within Pan Pan, I've had great opportunities to work with sculptors, choreographers, dancers, obviously actors, and even a neuroscientist on one production. The reason I have continued to work with Pan Pan is the way that they present their work. And I think this is best summed up by the Beckett scholar, Judith Wilkinson. I think she defined how Pan Pan's work is presented, and she termed it as installation theatre. And I just think this is a really good way to describe it, because it is, most of their work is removed from the conventional proscenium style format, you know, the front on idea. And I think she had a great quote that I'll get here, and she said, "The disciplinary mayhem that seems to circulate around Pan Pan forms part of a broader trend in the dissolution of artistic categories." Now, I just think that's probably pertinent to what we are exploring here, the dissolution of artistic categories. Now, on a funny end of this, I think that we are all collaborating until something goes wrong, and then it's your fault. But hopefully things rarely will go wrong, but they can do. But that's just a funny observation I've made. So I suppose when you are collaborating, you're navigating the hierarchy of egos to one way. You've got to set it aside. Your own ego as you go in, and be prepared for critical assessment on a daily basis of your work. So this is a lot different if I was working in a recording studio or on my own work in sound art, for instance, or, you know, any other singular endeavor that I'd have. So there's a sense of you have to also remain free of any preconceived assumption about the totality of the work. I've also found that about collaborating, not knowing how your work will fit into the larger whole is probably an interesting one. You never really get to see it until opening night, and then you're so nervous anyway about everything technically working. Will QLab crash? Will the microphones work, etc., you know? So anyway, not knowing, are trying to remain free of any preconceived assumptions. That's one big learning thing I have gained from working in theatre in a cross-collaborative way. So even though in theatre we are all essentially collaborating for the greater good of the production, I think everyone naturally stays within our own laneways. we may comment on certain aspects, but I've found that even though I'm just one part of a larger whole, I'm so focused on the audio end of things that things just go completely unnoticed to me about the stage direction, costumes, even, you know, lighting cues, unless they're related to something I'm doing. I'm specifically trying to support another area within the production. I am blinkered to listening intently that everything is working potentially well for the greater good, I suppose. I've always found that if I make a change, that is when there can be points of this antagonistic sort of people can get possessive over something. And if you do make a change to something, then there's that can lead to some differences. And that's where you have to defend why you've done it or why you think it's the good thing. So that can make for an exciting ride. I should also say here that one of the principles I found working in theatre or any other medium where I have to work with a team is I never let them use any other sound or music, anything audio related, except from my own work. And the reason for that is it's a well-known fact that people get obsessed with temp tracks or any other cue. So if you give them a little Mozart or Beethoven or a sound effect that you didn't design, then they get so attached to it that it's hard for you then. You end up just chasing that sound, which is pointless. So if I'm contacted by anyone to start working on a production, the first thing I do is I will say, please do not use any other sound. Tell me what you're looking for and I will give you works. And that way, it just means that I'm not chasing my tail. Everything I will be in from the ground floor, so to speak. So, and it's much easier then to find a way in if people are discussing your own work that you've supplied to them rather than we want it to sound like X, Y, and Z, then you're on the back foot from the get-go. So that's one thing I've learned is never let the production use any other sound except your own. When I'm in the initial stages of design, I suppose you're thinking of what audio system do you have? I guess what budget do you have first? And this is when collaboration can collapse because everyone's wants the best, the newest, whatever is your dream piece of equipment. So the budgets, I suppose. So you're thinking of, I'm thinking of the audio system. So that is when there is no collaboration. It is purely down to audio engineering basics or psychoacoustic presentation of certain system engineering, audio system engineering principles. That's when you're on your own, I guess. And they don't need to know why you have the speakers time aligned or why you're choosing this microphone above another one. Nobody needs to know that. All they want to do is hear the results, so to speak. And that goes as well for the listener, the audience. A question, are we collaborating with the audience? I can't remember what artist said that an artwork is never finished until, or an artwork is not completed until it's experienced by an audience member. I mean, we are asking them to pretend or to suspend disbelief until the end or for the duration of the work. So is that not collaboration? Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. So in summary, I would say for me, collaboration is about looking at one's own ego and in some ways letting go of creative control. But that can lead to unpredictable but positive results in my experience. And in turn, that can produce some nice hybrids of new work because we're all mucking in together. And that's it from me. Thank you very much for your time and listening.
So that's it for today's episode. Thank you very much to our contributors, and please stay tuned. Alongside this episode, part two should already have landed. This includes audio papers by Paul Clark, Melanie Wilson, and Alison Campbell with Meta Cohen. Thank you very much, and goodbye.